You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Isabella Stewart Gardner, Louisa May Alcott, Lucy Stone. You know them as some of history's legendary Boston women. But what if I told you that Dr. Susan Dimmock might have been among them if she had lived long enough? Dr. Dimmock died at 28, but not before running Roxbury's New England Hospital for Women and Children, performing groundbreaking surgeries, and providing forward-looking care for women and children while bucking trends in medical establishments across multiple continents in the 1800s. Her legacy, though influential, has largely remained in the shadows, but Susan Wilson's doing something about that with the book Women and Children First, The Trailblazing Life of Susan Dimmock, MD. Susan's here in the studio to tell us more about the book, about Dr. Dimmock. Welcome.
It's important to say which Susan is in the studio
today. That's
right.
Well, this is a good situation in that I can just say Dr. Dimmock and I can say Susan Wilson and we can keep them separated.
There you go.
So listen, here's how we're going to set this up. There is a riddle that Boston University used in some research back in 2014. And I'm going to read you the riddle. A father and son are in a horrible car crash that kills the dad. The son is rushed to the hospital just as he's about to go under the knife. The surgeon says, "I can't operate. That boy is my son. Explain." And when they did this, the researchers ran the riddle by two groups, 197 BU psychology students, 103 kids, ages 7 to 17, from Brookline summer camps. And in both groups, only 15% of the kids and 14% of the BU students came up with the answer. Do you know what the answer is?
I haven't got a clue.
Mom. Mom is the surgeon. And we all thought about that after reading about Dr. Susan Dimmock.
Wow.
Because she was fighting to be the woman surgeon who gave quality health care to women. That's the story, right?
That's a big story, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you first come across her?
Do you want the short form or the long form?
Short form.
For
I
short
guess.
Form, okay. I first
but
came
thank you for asking.
I first came across her 3 decades ago. I used to write, for about 9 years, I wrote history columns for the Boston Globe, and I used to look for interesting stories. I found, as flipping through some old newspapers, a story of a horrible shipwreck, and noticed that it was headline stories, not only in Boston, but in New York.
Spoiler alert, folks, by the way.
Oh,
go ahead.
Well, you already said she died.
I did. Yeah. It
anyway,
is history.
So I discovered this story and decided it would make a great story for my Globe column. And so I wrote the story. Discovered, among other things, that her grave, that the hospital was in her name, that the New England Hospital for Women and Children still exists today, but its DBA is the Dimmock Center, and that also that her graveyard, her grave over at Forest Hill Cemetery in Jamaica Plain, her grave was disintegrating. So I helped create, after I finished the story, created the Dimmock Heritage Fund. We got together a bunch of people, replaced her stone in granite. And then I lectured about it for a while, along with the head of the Dimmock Center, and then left it for 20 years. 20 years later, someone asked me if I would do a lecture about her. I said, I haven't lectured about her in 20 years. I did the lecture. There was standing room only. It was at the JP Historical Society. And people said, where is the book? And I went, well, somebody must have written this as a book because it's such a great story. I discovered they didn't. And so I applied to the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis with this as a project in 2016. And that's what I've been doing on the side for the last 7 years.
So here we are. And listen, hold the phone, everybody. Let's give some perspective here. All of that, right? And all the things we've said. But just to put it in perspective, one of the things that was stunning to me in reading the book is apparently in the world of women in medicine, there are seven women that are like the seven women of the 1800s in medicine across the globe. And Dr. Susan Dimmock from Boston is one of them. So, I mean, we're not just talking about big in Boston history. We are talking about one of seven in the history of women in modern medicine.
Well, okay, so you're referencing the Zurich Seven.
Yes.
Yes. And so essentially what happened is when it was discovered in Boston, the New England Hospital for Women and Children was started in 1862 by Marie Zakrzewska. And basically women only got in the back door or as the single woman in some medical school, and all the established medical schools would not accept women. So Susan, being rejected by Harvard Med, which was the biggest deal in the area, she was rejected in 1867. And she was rejected. So they decided to go to Zurich, and she was one of seven women from around the world, Russia, Scotland, Switzerland, accepted into the University of Zurich, which was way more progressive than Harvard. And so Harvard, by the way, Harvard Med didn't start accepting women until 1945.
She would have been in her 90s if
she would have been 98 if she waited for that. Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, these women, each one of them did excellent at the school, fit in fine with the guys, went back to their respective countries, and were all essentially rock stars in medicine and helped other women get into medicine.
So I want to juxtapose that to some sound from the Today Show in March of 2020. Here we have Dr. Arielle Canters, Dr. Sarah Schubeck, and Dr. Shannon Fazen, surgery residents at Michigan Medicine, University of Michigan Hospital.
People thought I was overly ambitious to choose a surgical subspecialty given my circumstances as a single mother. I didn't know any single mothers that were ENT surgeons, but I told myself that I would be the first.
I've always wanted to be a surgeon, and throughout medical school in particular, I always told that surgeons don't smile, and therefore I would never be happy in surgery because I didn't have the personality of a surgeon.
When interviewing for residency or about to, I got the advice to not wear my engagement ring and not talk about wanting to have children.
Okay, 2020. And I'm reading your book and I'm thinking, is part of this because we don't know the story of Dr. Susan Dimmick in the United States, of this hospital for women and children that was breaking barriers on innovative medical care in the 1800s here? And so we buried a story that would have given the lie to what we're talking about, you know, a century and a half later?
Well, people have been trying to bury this since the beginning. I mean, you may remember from the book that women who were trying to do anything professional in the 19th century, words that were used in newspapers and magazines and books, they called them unsexed, manly. When
suggested it affected their fertility.
Oh, absolutely. There was a whole book written about how if the larger women's brains got, the smaller their uterus was. And with apparent evidence, which of course was not evidence at all. But this bias has existed forever, and it's we still haven't completely transcended it, no.
So, okay, so let's go back to Dr. Susan Dimmick here, and we're with another Susan, Susan Wilson, who is actually the Omni Parker House historian and author of a book, Women and Children First, The Trailblazing Life of Susan Dimmick, MD. Because I want to, she's in Zurich, she joins the Fab Seven, right? They spread out across, you know, at least Europe and the U.S., and they innovate, start, start, start. She comes back, she becomes the resident director of a hospital that has just moved to Roxbury, mm-hmm. that is focused on healthcare for women and children,
yep.
exclusively.
Yes.
And over a period of a few years, she becomes one of the best surgeons, just sort of mic drop, in the United States. They innovate in all kinds of things about how you provide safe childbirth, how you do gynecological services for women. She just works nonstop. And she launches the first formal professional nurses training.
She actually, they had already had some kind of nurses training, but there were no professional schools for nurses. Nursing was kind of an avocation, something that...
And looked down upon.
Oh, totally looked down upon. I mean, an example was Bellevue Hospital in New York that would go to the local prison and tell prostitutes that they could either stay in prison or they could become a nurse. And
sorry, nurses, this was a long time ago.
This was way long time ago.
Yeah.
So Susan was very important. She came back from Europe having met Florence Nightingale, and also other people who realized nursing was essential to doing good to surgery or any kind of medicine, and so took the kind of ad hoc program at the hospital and professionalized it, created the first professional nursing school in the U.S., and graduated the first professional nurse, a woman named Linda Richards, whose diploma and uniforms are at the Smithsonian because she was she's like the George Washington of nursing.
Unbelievable. Okay, so how did medicine change based on the work that was being done at this hospital, essentially on a hill in Roxbury?
Well, it's medicine was used to be basically a charity. I mean, for example, Susan was the only person at the hospital who was paid. She was paid $300 a year to be the resident physician, chief surgeon, teach all the nurses and the interns.
And that was about half of what teachers were being paid at the
time,
correct?
That was half what teachers, the chef at the Parker House was being paid $5,000 a year at the same time.
Go back, remind us what the doctor was being paid at the time?
$300 a year.
$300 a year.
Yeah. So, but she had a private practice in the meantime in downtown Boston to pay off her college loans. But anyway, medicine was, it was just beginning to come into its scientific era. Within another 10 years, it would have been there. But they were, it was just on the cusp. They were leaving the old days. They were leaving the days of, you know, of bleeding people, you know, to make them get better, of just chopping things off instead of actually curing things.
Well, and you were headed into, you referenced this a number of times, we were just heading into the time where we would understand germs,
exactly,
sterilization, et cetera.
Exactly. And there were still people around in other hospitals in Boston, doctors who would go from dissecting a cadaver to delivering a baby and not wash their hands in between. Which is why a lot of the hospitals just had to close down because of something called puerperal fever, which was childbed fever, which the doctors were actually spreading because they didn't know about germs, or germ theory hadn't been proven. It kind of existed. But there was still a belief in this thing called miasma, which was this cloud of noxious fumes that might float from one place to another. And people still believed in that. And of course, there was no scientific evidence. So Susan was just on the cusp of that. But because she'd studied in Europe, which was more advanced than America in medicine at the time, she brought back the idea of washing. She also brought back the idea, she brought the first thermometers here to Boston and discovered that if they tracked a patient's temperature, that they could really find out if they were doing better or worse. And it was the thermometers were like a foot long, had to be kept under your armpit for 15 minutes. It was quite the trick. And because there was no staples to buy graph paper, she would have her students there at the hospital draw graphs by hand every night that they could use to track the patient's temperatures.
All right. So now we get to the part about why we don't know about her. And this is a fascinating story of her own. We've had the author Michael Togas on a number of times. And he, part of what he's done is written several nonfiction books about shipwrecks, right? And there's a whole book you could write just about how we lost her, which is on a shipwreck when she's 28 years old.
Yes, yes. And which is why the book is called Women and Children First, because that's what the hospital served. And that was the thing that didn't exist in 1875. We all think of Titanic in 1912, the idea of everybody saving the women and children first. It was really every man for himself at the time.
Name of the ship was the SS
Schiller. Schiller, after the German poet, yeah. And so she and two friends went across. She was on a break, wanted to go visit her friends in Europe and to buy some medical instruments, which were only sold there, or the really good ones were there. And it just, the weather got worse. It was the time where you needed to see the sun or the stars to navigate properly. They were aiming for the English Channel. They got caught off the Isles of Scilly, which can be very treacherous because of the tides. They had no idea where they were at the time, and they got lodged on a rock. And it was, they thought, well, if it's low tide, we'll get off the rock when it gets to be high tide. What they didn't realize is when the boat lodged on a rock accidentally, it had punctured it. And basically, little by little, they kept telling people to come up from steerage, from second class into first class. And the waves, as it was stuck on the rock, kept blowing over and blowing people over.
And destroyed the lifeboats and the physical space. And so there was no way to get off.
No way to get off, yeah. And even
mostly only the crew survived.
There were 372 people on board. Only 37 survived. One woman survived. And yeah, it was mostly the crew because the crew knew how to do it. Some of them like actually lashed themselves to the poles and just stayed there.
Yeah. All right. So one more piece of sound. This
sure.
is a courtesy of Northwell Health in New York, March 2022. Dr. Jamie Ullman, neurosurgeon and director of neurosurgery, and Dr. Julissa Gerardo, who's a thoracic surgeon.
20, 30 years in the past, there was that perception that women had, if they're going to be one of the boys, they have to sort of act like one of the boys. When I was in the process of trying to figure out why I didn't match in neurosurgery, I was calling around to various program directors, and I got one answer from somebody, oh, you're just too feminine.
I definitely have experienced the walking into a room with a male nurse or male PA, and they definitely assume, even after I say I'm Dr. so-and-so, they assume the men are the doctors. It doesn't bother me. I like the reactions I get. I like the surprise.
If Susan Dimmock were here today and she heard that, what would she say?
she didn't bother about criticisms or people worrying about things. She just forged ahead and did her stuff. You know, she was also, I mean, she was, they said she had a mixture of Yankee grit and Southern charm. She was from North Carolina. And so she was often just very charming and sweet and just brushed off criticisms or things people said you couldn't do and kept on going. She also ruled the hospital like a Napoleon. So she was tough, yet she was sweet and gentle at the same time.
All right. Susan Wilson, who is the Omni Parker House historian, is author of Women and Children First, The Trailblazing Life of Susan Dimmock, MD. Susan Wilson, thanks for the book and thanks for being here today.
You bet. Thanks a lot.